for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. With so much at stake for the health care bill, President Obama's delayed an overseas trip until June. After getting bipartisan support, the HIRE Act was signed, but Treasury Secretary Geithner said unemployment is likely to remain high. And why did government financial auditors get big bonuses despite missing warning signs of the financial crisis? Join me for the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup. Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine is here, Juan Williams of NPR, and Chris Eliza of TheWashingtonPost.com. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. Check out our brand new website at drshow.org. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's Friday. It's the hour. It's the day. It's the weekend of healthcare. Chris Eliza.
It's the Sunday of our reckoning. After months and months and months, the final, last, seriously, we mean it this time, vote on healthcare, we think, is going to happen sometime Sunday, late afternoon or evening in the House. This is something that has been a very, very long time coming, something that was dealt a significant setback when Scott Brown in Massachusetts was elected. This bill was on the verge of passing. Scott Brown's election gave Democrats one seat less than they needed to break Republican filibusters, forcing a re-strategizing of how this vote will pass. It also meant, it's like Groundhog Day. It meant two more months of procedure and process, neither of which are good for passing the bill or for Democratic political fortunes. More talk about special deals that were in the Senate bill, and now more talk about how the mechanics of how this bill is actually going to be passed in the House.
And before we get to exactly that, Eugene Robinson wrote in this morning's Washington Post that Democrats had finally figured out they had to get out there and fight. The president is now fighting big time. Does Nancy Pelosi have the numbers she needs, Juan?
Well, no, I don't think that they have them lined up yet. They need 216. They've got about 253, I think it is, Democrats in the House. And so she is still struggling to get those votes. Now, they got a big boost yesterday when the Congressional Budget Office scorecard indicated that, in fact, this health care reform package is going to pay for itself and has some savings included if, over the course of the life of the bill, the Congress, in fact, holds to its promises in terms of cutting the size of Medicare and Medicaid and make some other tax changes, such as what they call the doc fix, how you reimburse doctors. All of these steps would have to be taken to try to draw in and make sure that this doesn't become a burden on the budget.
What are the holdouts waiting for, Karen?
At this point, everybody I'm talking to within the vote counting operation sounds very, very optimistic. They're waiting for a few. They all wanted to see these numbers, and the numbers were pretty reassuring. They're holding out for a little bit more reassurance that the Senate, which is a whole other ballgame, will actually follow through on its promise to make some fixes to the bill through this procedure we now all know about called reconciliation. My understanding is that the Senate is working on this right now, that either 51 senators are going to sign a letter promising they're going to vote for these fixes, or rather 50 senators plus Joe Biden, or possibly they might actually sign on as co-sponsors of the reconciliation bill. So that's one of the things. But at this point, as I said, that everyone's sounding on the Democratic side very optimistic. The feeling is that the momentum is going their way.
But what about this deem and pass strategy, Chris?
I mean, it is amazing to me, Diane, that two arcane parliamentary procedures, as Karen mentioned, reconciliation, the Senate, deem and pass in the House, have become the center of this debate. It boiled down. every debate in the House, unlike the Senate, is run by a rule that is produced by the Rules Committee that governs the amount of debate, votes, amendments, all those sorts of things. What the Democrats are going to try to do if they use Demon Pass, and we're not sure that they will, but what they will say is the vote on the rule, which would go to the House floor, you vote on the rule, the whole House votes on it to say, yes, we approve of running the debate this way, would be a de facto approving of the Senate bill. Now, there's a reason many of these House members in tough districts do not want to be directly on the record voting for the Senate bill. And two of them are the Cornhusker kickback, the now infamous cutout for Ben Nelson in Nebraska of Medicaid, and the Louisiana purchase. Again, these are Republican terms that have come to become, common parlance, a special deal for Louisiana and Senator Mary Landrieu. The bill has become defined in a lot of ways by these special deals. They are very deeply unpopular with the American public. This is part of the fix that will happen. The problem is they will have to vote for this package, the Senate package, before the fixes can happen, therefore opening them up to political attacks in the fall.
To which I say, oh, please. I mean, everyone is going to recognize this vote for what it is, right, which is the passage of the Senate bill. I've really been sort of mystified as to why they are, tying themselves into these contortions. It isn't like their opponents are going to forget that the Cornhusker kickback was in this bill. I would really love to know, whose vote does this really make a difference with passing it in the rule versus passing the actual bill?
Well, I think that part of it is, and this is so interesting to me, how the White House really fell down so badly.
Early.
I mean, they have just given up in terms of the conversation with the American people. The focus coming, and I think this is part of the sort of background debate not going on in Washington about Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod, the top aides at the White House to President Obama. They really focused on getting the votes in the Congress because they had Democratic majorities in the House and Senate. So they figured, you know what, this is just about getting votes. We don't have to go out there and sell it to the American people. There was an election that decided that. Wow, that opened the door for Republicans. It opened the door for Sarah Palin's death panels. It opened the door for all this focus on the process, which is very unpopular, the so-called sausage making that looks very tawdry to people, deal making, all this Nebraska Cornhusker kickback, Gatorade for the folks in the Medicare Advantage in Florida. All of a sudden, it looks like there's something seedy going on. It's some backroom deal.
Although, had there not been for one Senate election in Massachusetts, this whole strategy would have looked brilliant.
And that's one thing. I do think Juan is right in that I think they miscalculated from the beginning that this was solely an inside play, that they had to convince a handful of senators and a handful of House members to go along with this, and they didn't have to really worry about public opinion. I think the thing that remains difficult, the White House's take on this is, let's pass it, and then we're going to go out and sell it to the American people. Once they see that some of the death panels, some of these things that Republicans have floated out, once they see that's not in the bill, everything's going to get better. Here's the problem if you're a vulnerable House member. You look back, a Democrat, you look back on the last year, and you say, well, what were you doing in that time? Weren't you selling the bill in that time? And it gets back to the old marketing phrase, Diane. If the dog doesn't like the dog food, it doesn't matter how good the marketing and the salesmanship is. That, to me, I think is the nub from a political perspective.
Here's what you do then if you're a Democrat right now. You're saying, well, what is it that I can go out and campaign on that I can say to the American people, here's the difference? Well, you're going to say, you know what? Everybody's going to have insurance coverage. I think it's 32 million additional people will be covered in terms of insurance. You say, you know what, if you have a child that's just out of college, that child can stay on your insurance package now until that child is 26 years old.
Right.
That's a big difference for a lot of people. I speak as someone who's the father of a child in that situation. You say, you know what, we're going to expand Medicaid so that, in fact, more people are now eligible and will be covered. You say we're going to cover over the donut hole in terms of the prescription drugs for seniors. You say we're going to have an insurance exchange that's going to drive down some of these rates and put employers in a better position to offer vouchers and let people go get their own insurance. And almost nobody, this is the shocking part of this, most Americans aren't going to be affected by it.
But did the miscalculation come on the part of the White House early on? Who believed that this kind of bipartisanship really could exist after the election?
I think so, though. I think it's easier in hindsight to criticize them, Diane, for thinking that than it was at the time. Look, they had just come off of an election in which Barack Obama had won 365 electoral votes. He had carried places like North Carolina, Indiana, places that Democrat – Virginia, places Democrat hadn't carried since the 1960s, LBJ. So the what now looks like irrational exuberance was just plain old exuberance at that point. You know, I do think, though, that the economic stimulus vote, which came early in the 111th Congress, should have been a leading indicator of the difficulty of making healthcare bipartisan. If you remember back, three total Republicans crossed party lines to vote for that bill. All three of them were in the Senate. One of them is now a Democrat, Arlen Specter. The other two were Susan Collins and Olympia Snow from Maine. The lack of any bipartisanship with that bill, I think, was an ill omen as they moved into healthcare.
But then what those Republicans did, not only those who voted for it, but those who voted against it, was to go to their home districts and say, look what a wonderful thing I brought you. I brought you all this money because of the stimulus bill.
Well, I think they miscalculated on the other side, too. I mean, for one thing, they should have recognized earlier that they were not going to get any Republican support, but they also miscalculated with their own base. They let the argument over the public option drag on for way too long, and the White House never believed that was going to happen.
Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Juan Williams of NPR, Chris Saliza, he's the author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about the threats of constitutional reality to this health care bill. Stay with us. And so far, we've been talking about health care legislation, which may or may not be voted on Sunday. Right now, it looks as though it will, but already waiting in the wings are some people, some states, which are going to challenge the constitutionality of this health care bill. This morning, we heard the Attorney General of the state of Virginia say, this is unconstitutional. We're going to go after it. On what kind of grounds, Chris?
Well, you know, the grounds are that you cannot mandate individuals to buy insurance or to opt into the insurance program. You know, I'm just looking. There's a $695 penalty for people within this plan if they do not opt into insurance. There's a penalty for employers who don't provide affordable insurance. The idea in the states, and this is, you know, this is the since the founding of the Republic, the battle between state and federal rights and sort of who has precedent and prominence in this has been going on. The simple reality is that if you look back, federal law trumps state law. This is a political ploy done in large part to protest the idea of federal encroachment, with the biggest champion of this being the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who has threatened secession due to the sort of overwhelming involvement of the federal government. But this is even the people in Idaho, even where it's been signed into law, even these people acknowledge we are likely to be trumped by federal law. This is more to
Oklahoma
say.
Oklahoma has already said
Right.
They passed it, too, in their legislature to say, you know what, we want the ability to opt out of health care reform, not in specific in the way the Virginia deal is. They want to opt out of it. And what you see here, I think, is a strategy on the part of Republicans. It starts here in Washington, which is, I mean, I think properly called obstructionism. But it's largely based on this idea. If you allow the Democrats and Barack Obama to pass health care reform, it is a major signature piece of legislation. And it will largely be the basis on which he will run a reelection campaign in 2012. And he'll say to the American people, I was able to deliver for you on the change that I promised during the initial campaign.
But then
Republicans will say, no, wait a second. We don't want to give that to Barack Obama and the Democrats. And that's why you've seen Mitch McConnell. I think there was a piece in the New York Times this week about how the Republicans have launched a specific obstruction effort to hold together, and it has been tremendously successful, and it now extends to the states, but it also extends to Republican actors on the stage. Republicans ranging from the talk radio show host to cable news all over who have brought up the process, who have brought up objections that have made this thing so unpopular. Right now, this package is unpopular with the American people. Don't forget, most Americans think this is a bad deal. If you ask them about specific items in it, they'll go along. If you ask them about the need for health care reform, they'll go along, but not in terms of this bill.
But back to the constitutional argument, I am no constitutional scholar, but I don't see the difference between, I mean, the federal government already requires me to buy social insurance in the form of something gets taken out of my paycheck every week for Social Security. Something gets taken out of my paycheck every week to pay for my Medicare when I get older. So I really don't see how, in terms of a constitutional principle, they're going to say that requiring people to buy health insurance is any different except for the fact that you are paying those premiums to now a private company.
And what about auto insurance?
Well, that's done by the states, and that's a somewhat different situation. But again, except for the difference that this is requiring me to pay something to a private company, I don't see what the difference is.
All right. And finally, the question on the student loan overhaul. Why was it attached to this bill, Juan?
Well, it's a quick way to get it done, and it's a major piece of legislation that has been argued about. The opposition to it is coming from people who say it's going to cost you all the jobs in the student loan industry. It's about 30,000 jobs, Diane, not to be smirked at, especially at the time of recession. But the larger picture is this, that there's a lot of money to be saved by taking the middleman out of the game. And the middleman here has been that student loan industry that really skates by because the government guarantees all the loans to the students. So if the student defaults, the government still picks up the price and there's no damage to the person who's offering the insurance. That has allowed a terrific profit margin for this industry. And what the Obama administration is saying, now we can take that savings and put it back into student loans, especially for poor kids in terms of Pell Grants that will go up from about, I guess it's $5,500 to about $6,000 a year instead.
I'm told there were some screaming arguments behind closed doors over this exact issue, that a number of senators from Midwestern states that have the industry in it were arguing this will cost jobs in their states, and that people from other places were saying, look, you know, we represent large urban areas with poor minority kids. So, you know, it's a lot of money that is going to be putting those kids through college.
You know, I think context is important. We get so wrapped up in healthcare, Diane, rightfully so. But if you look at any national poll, and this is to Juan and Karen's point, jobs and the economy remain by far the leading issue on most people's minds in terms of what's the most important issue facing the country, what's the most important issue guiding your vote. And so I think that everything that the Obama administration will do from now on, and they will argue that both healthcare and the student loan program will help in their own way toward this, they will do everything they can to focus on jobs and the economy. The question is it too little too late for Democrats up in the midterms? I think to Juan's point, healthcare and a real change in the reform in the student loan industry are two huge signature domestic policy accomplishments that the president can take to the American public in 2012. The problem is he is operating under a very different timeline than the people who will be voting on this healthcare bill at some point on Sunday. They only have about 6 months to make their case. He has the better part of 2 years.
Right. Here's an email from Phil in Indianapolis. He said, in the 60s, Ronald Reagan and conservatives were steadfastly opposed to Medicare and Medicaid, calling it socialist legislation. It seems to me arguments used today to scare people from supporting health care sound very much like the same arguments used by conservatives back then. Does anyone know if old people today, who were very much against Medicare or Medicaid then, couldn't live without it today?
You know what's different, though, about that argument and this argument was that argument divided largely along ideological lines, but that those bills passed with bipartisan majorities, that there were a number of moderate and even liberal Republicans back then who actually voted for this, and believe it or not, a lot of conservative Democrats who voted against it. But Washington has become such a different place, I think, that everything now is based on your party ID.
Well, and think about...
Let me just
add
quickly,
go ahead.
Diane, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'm very fascinated by this larger demographic change going on in America that has so many young people in the country and so many older people in the country. And I think it's reflected in what Karen's talking about. The primary opposition to this health care reform bill, which, as I pointed out earlier, is not popular with the American people, comes from seniors. Why does it come from seniors? If you ask them about it, what they say is they think it's going to result in their health care costs going up and reductions in terms of Medicare benefits, and especially that Medicare Advantage, the so-called Gatorade. The Florida fix was an attempt to try to get people there to support. But it's that older generation now, as opposed to what we saw, let's say, with in the 60s with the passage of Medicare and so forth, that now that older generation is saying, wait, we don't want this. We like what we've got. We've
but
got a good
what's
deal.
What's the reality?
The reality
isn't Medicare cost going to go up for seniors?
Yeah, it'll go up.
Under this.
They're understandably skeptical that you cannot squeeze $500 billion right out of this program over the next 10 years just by increased efficiencies, that at some point this is going to come out of their hides.
Right. Now, the Republicans and now President Obama say there's waste and fraud, and we were going to be aggressive about going after it. But the fact is this also, that the projection for costs for Medicare and Medicaid are just unreasonable. It's not, the program would explode unless you have some
exactly
reasonable cuts or you had large tax increases to pay for it. Somebody's going to have to do something.
And remember, to Juan's point about seniors being the most skeptical, seniors are also the most reliable voters in low turnout midterm elections.
And they give money.
That nexus of most skeptical about this major domestic policy proposal by the president and most likely to vote in a midterm is why you see so much hesitancy among Democrats
all
to vote
right
for it.
Let's talk for a moment. What happens if this does not go forward?
It's hugely problematic, both for House Democrats but also for President Obama. Look, this bill may wind up being hugely problematic for both anyway. It's probably problematic on a political level for House Democrats and Senate Democrats anyway. It could be a good
and
thing for President
his
Obama.
Argument,
that
isn't
is
it?
Look, the basis of the Obama candidacy, the Obama presidency, has been making Washington work for average people. We will bring this candidate, this president, has a unique ability to solve the partisan fissures in Washington and bring people together. That was why and how he was elected.
How'd that work out for you,
yeah,
Chris?
To quote Sarah Palin, how's the hopey changey thing working for you? But the point is, if he cannot get something that they have spent a year literally working on, and Juan mentioned this earlier, with 59 now seats in the Senate and 250 plus seats in the House, it fundamentally undermines a pillar of why Barack Obama got elected. That's why, although I don't think the votes are there yet, I still find it hard to believe, though I'm always willing to be surprised in politics, I still find it hard to believe that they will not get to 216 simply because of what the White House believes is at stake.
Oh, I agree. I don't think they're even going to have the vote unless they know they've got the votes. As somebody on the Hill described it to me yesterday, we don't have the votes yet, but we're not short either.
Here's an email from Lynn in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She says, I'm confused. Depending on what you read or hear, proposed health care legislation is going to cost trillions of dollars, but at the same time cut the deficit by billions. Is it possible to do both?
It is possible to do both. The cost of the healthcare system, first of all, is inevitably going to go up. You just cannot put that many more, over 30 million new people into the system without costs going up. But guess what? They're going up anyway. And they're paying for this. That's that is the deficit reduction. It comes from the fact that in addition to trying to wring some efficiencies out of the system, they're raising a lot of taxes. They're doing a lot of programmatic cuts. And that is how it pays for itself and reduces the deficit.
Yeah, taxes on people who – on the wealthy in terms of unearned income, especially now on this new package. And you also have consideration now, as Karen was saying, you'll have some cuts in Medicare. And Medicaid, so that, you know, as you go along, there will be some impact down the road. But altogether, according to the CBO, it will save you money.
Juan Williams of NPR, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about the jobs bill that President Obama signed into law yesterday, the so-called HIRE Act. Juan, what's it going to do?
Well, this is a, you know, it's very interesting because this is an example, actually, of some bipartisanship. You got 11 Republican votes in this bill. And what it's going to do, very simply, is reward employers who hire somebody who's been out of work for 6 months or more. And it's going to give them the opportunity to even do more in terms of tax breaks, in terms of Social Security payroll taxes, if they keep that person on the payroll for a year. So this is an effort, and it's viewed as a start because it's really a small amount of money is compared, and a small amount of jobs are projected, about 250,000 jobs, as opposed to the 8 million jobs that have been lost in the recession. But it's viewed as a start, a first effort by the Democrats to focus on jobs and then to do more down the road. They're trying to look at other job proposals. They don't quite have the support there yet, but this is a big step for the Democrats.
But Treasury Secretary Geithner is still warning going to be hard to build more than 100,000 jobs a year.
Yes, he says that, in fact, we may be, because more people are coming back into the workforce as we have these first few signs that the economy is recovering, that, in fact, we're likely to see the unemployment numbers even inch up before the end of the year. And of course, this is the kind of talk that absolutely, you know, terrifies the Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate. What's interesting, though, is as I talk to strategists, they say what they're hoping is that people will at least get the sense that the economy is coming back. And the historic parallel that they are drawing is the 1934 election, where if you looked at the numbers, the depression was unemployment was still ticking up. But people just had a sense, first of all, that the government was actively trying to do something about it. It was on their side and that they were going to get their arms around
it. They began to feel better.
You know, I think that this speaks – I agree 100% with Karen. I think that this speaks, though, to the – and I come back to this a lot in terms of the politics of these issues, the differing timelines that the congressional Democrats and that the president – excuse me – are operating under. The projections here – unemployment 9.7% now, 8.9% by the fourth quarter of 2011, 7.9% by the fourth quarter of 2012, which also happens to be when the 2012 election, presidential election will be. The problem is that Bloomberg had a fascinating story about a week and a half ago that there are many elements, including the stock market, that would suggest that the policies the president has put into place and implemented by Treasury Secretary Geithner are in fact working. The problem is that most average people do not consume these sort of detailed financial numbers. They say unemployment is at 9.7%. It's a very easy marker to say things haven't gotten better. We spent all this money, the government got involved, and things haven't gotten better. And from a political perspective, Diane, you know, I always say the candidate whose slogan can fit on a bumper sticker is usually the candidate that's going to win. Simplification, simplification, simplification. That unemployment number, if it stays where it is or goes higher, is very, very tough,
you know,
for Democrats to sell.
Right now, as I was looking at a Pew poll this week that said, and this was just so telling to me, that a majority of Americans, 54%, now say someone in their home has been without a job or looking for work in the past year.
54%.
That was compared with just about 40% in February of 2009. So that's a big jump. Most Americans right now, and when you ask people, did they get a pay raise or a better job in the last year, it's only 24%, and that's fallen from about 50% in January.
Well, they're hoping to put out there a lot of money for construction, and that's going to hit one sector of the population.
I just think it's important. Juan mentioned this, but I think it's important to reiterate. We're talking about the most optimistic projection is 250,000 jobs created by the end of the year. I mean, the president essentially said this is a small step, hopefully the first of many steps. What I think they want to do is put Republicans in the uncomfortable position of voting against things that would help create jobs.
However,
that's one of the biggest
small.
Right. But you know what, Diane, to be able to say we wanted to give $18 billion to help create jobs, help small businesses, and Republicans voted against it, that's a heck of a lot better talking point than we're going to pass this health care bill because we're going to convince you, even though you don't right now, that you're going to like it.
Chris Salizza, he's the author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com. Short break, and when we come back, your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org, by the Avis Family Foundation, supporting expanded foreign news online and on air, and by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. Top international diplomats call on Israel and the Palestinians to resume peace negotiations. CIA Director Panetta says U.S. attacks have hobbled al-Qaeda. The stories behind this week's headlines and answers to your questions, the Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And before we get to the phones, let's hear from an emailer, Dave, who's in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, whose views represent many, many other emails. He says, it seems to me that to argue the government has no right to force people to buy insurance is a straw dog. Of course government can do that. Each of us who drives a car to have insurance to provide protection against unforeseen, the excuse that's done by the state, that it is done by the state, is weak. Certainly the fear that President Obama will get a win and use it for re-election is a driving force. The interests of the people be damned get elected and get reelected.
Well, here's the other side of this picture, because this is what I articulated to you earlier. But the other side of this picture, Diane, is as follows, and it's the Tea Party argument. It's the one that's being picked up by the states that are saying we're going to retain the option to get out of this deal. Is that, you know what, this is expansive government. This is government that's intrusive. This is government that's going to increase your taxes. It's going to take your guns away. It's going to tell your school children how they have to, what their standards are. This is government now that's big government. It's what leads to the claims of socialism and all the rest. You might argue that they're scare tactics, but for lots of people, it hits home.
Yeah, I do think that the whole, nanny state argument does resonate out there. But again, it's just, I think the large philosophical question for a lot of people is just, should we be living in a country where, close to 50 million people walk around with no health coverage? And guess what? They do get treated. And the rest of us are paying for it by emergency room visits.
Just very quickly, the idea that the emailer sort of says that people be damned and the politics get in the way. Republicans would come back and say, look at the polling. A majority of people for months have said they do not want this bill, and yet the Obama administration and the House and the Senate continue to move forward with it. Is that in the people's interest? I'm not agreeing with it. I'm just suggesting that the Republicans would defend what they are doing as fighting for the American people's interest.
But the only thing I would say about that is the White House has not been fighting as hard as those who would defeat.
Well, that was what I said to you earlier.
Exactly.
I think they lost because they gave up the public argument.
Right.
Instead, they focused on the inside game. And I think it has been to their detriment to no end to this very moment. But the fact is, as Chris just said, if you look at the polls, this is an unpopular health care reform proposal.
All right. We're going to open the phones, 800-433-8850 to Mason, Ohio. Good morning, Harry. You're on the air.
Yes, Diane. Look, I'm 83 years old. I'm very happy with Medicare. And if this, every voter in every state, they should tell the representatives and senators that their rate increases are going to go jump way up to the sky, 20, 30, 50%, or who knows, if this bill isn't passed. Thank you.
All right.
The caller, I think, speaks to the exact problem that the White House and Democrats have, which is people, even if you are not thrilled with your health care coverage, it's your health care coverage. And you sort of know how to navigate through it. People fear the unknown. They fear any change that it could wind up being positive change.
But wait a minute, Chris. What he said at the end was,
if it doesn't pass.
If it does not pass. So, in fact, he says, I'm very happy with my Medicare, but I realize if it doesn't pass, this is going to go sky high. Sounds to me as though Harry...
You know that Pew poll I was reading to you earlier?
Yeah.
It also had this little thing in it. It said 51% say their health care costs will increase if the proposed legislation becomes law. But then even more, 63% say they believe their health care costs will increase if there aren't changes
exactly.
made.
And guess what? They're both right.
You're right.
All right. Let's go to Laurel, Maryland. Good morning, Sam. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dan. I am calling regarding the Cadillac health insurance tax. I heard basically that it will any insurance that costs above $8,000 per year for family will be taxed. I think in 2018, I think this is the time when the Obama administration is out of the office if they win the second term. My concern is not about that I would have to pay taxes, but what I'm worried about is, as the taxes kicks in, all the healthy and young single people were never going to go into these insurances to actually provide meaningful insurance in terms of less exclusion and no limits on how much they will spend. And we go to these pseudo insurance that basically have a maximum, 500,000, 1 million maximum per life.
All right, Karen.
And basically we end up with a taxation plan versus a health quality plan. I think if we basically, I don't have any problem with taxation, by the way. I used to put all my life put Democrats, but with this plan, I think right now they are rushing it because they are worried about the election, not the.
Well, there were a couple of issues brought up here. One is, what exactly is health insurance? And this bill will actually clarify this for the first time ever. It will say everyone is required to have insurance, but it will have to be at least a bare minimum standard of insurance. You won't have these kind of just, catastrophic policies that people go out and buy now and sometimes find out, as, I wrote a cover story on my own brother discovering after he got sick that what he thought was insurance really wasn't. The second thing is the question of the so-called Cadillac tax. This is a very steep excise tax on very expensive plans. I believe in the latest legislation, it's something like plans that cost more than something like $27,000 a year to buy. Now, the reason they are doing this, and believe it or not, more people's insurance is going to get caught up in this than you think, is that they want to discourage both people from buying these plans and insurance companies from offering them. And economists will tell you that this is one of the few things in this bill that has actually got the potential to bring down healthcare cost increases in the long run.
You know, and the simple fact, people never like – if you ask people, do you think everyone should be covered? They say, oh, yeah, absolutely. We should cover everyone. It's a human right. And then you say, well, we're going to need to pay for it somehow. and that's likely to come from taxes. The support craters, you know, again, Karen made this point earlier. This is – adding this 32 million people is going to raise the overall cost. The money has to come from somewhere.
All
and
right.
The political reality, that is tough to swallow.
And
sometimes.
Let's go to West Palm Beach, Florida. Good morning, Marshall.
Good morning. I'd like to talk about premiums for a minute. My wife and I are just two people. Last year, our premiums were $1,900 a quarter. This year, they're $2,375 a quarter. When I call the insurance company, they just say it's a blanket raise for everybody, right? And if you want to talk about scare tactics, if you look back in history a little bit, when we tried to institute Social Security and when we tried to institute Medicare, the Republicans, I believe, used the same scare tactics they're using now.
Marshall, do you buy – so you don't get insurance from your employer. You have to go out and buy it on your own?
I have to buy it on my own.
Okay. Marshall is one of the 9% of the population that is getting the worst deal imaginable under the current situation. These are the people who have to, because they don't get it in large groups, they don't get it from their employer, they have to go out and negotiate with insurance companies on their own. And these are the people who are getting socked in some places with 30% rate increases this year. One thing this bill will do is allow these people to go into big exchanges where they will become parts of big groups like the rest of us who are lucky enough to get insurance from our employers.
Okay. Believe it or not, there's other news this week. Let's talk about what we've learned this week about the bonuses given to government regulators. Chris Saliza.
You know, Diane, I guess it probably shouldn't be terribly surprising, given the massive bonuses that were given to the private industry, that there was an element of this. What we saw is that three agencies, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, the Office of Thrift Supervision, and the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, which, to be honest, I didn't know we had an Office of the Comptroller of the Currency until this, those three groups got $19 million in bonuses in 2003-2006, largely to financial regulators whose job it was to double check the bank's books.
How come?
That's the question we don't have an answer to. The whole private industry
Chris,
bonuses.
Chris, I've never seen you at a loss for words.
All I can say is, heck of a job, FDIC.
They get the bonuses because they meet certain standards, certain benchmarks. And, you know, this is an extension. These guys take care of themselves in such an incestuous way. You know, the Wall Street people say, oh, we've got to give out bonuses, because if we don't give out the bonuses, they'll go to another company.
Right.
You say, well, go to another company. Goodness gracious, look at the results that you guys have been getting for us. I saw a piece on 60 Minutes this week about Michael Lewis's new book. And in the midst of it, they say, well, here's the guy who lost billions of dollars in Wall Street. This guy still walked away with millions in bonuses. It's unbelievable. And it extends then into government supervision. These are the folks who should have seen that whole credit default swap thing was a joke. They should have seen that what about the credit agencies? Why is it that Standard & Poor's and Moody's, why aren't they held up to public scorn?
And how does all this affect the debate over what Chris Dodd wants to do in terms of setting up some kind of regulatory agency?
Well, it ramps up the already strong populist sentiment in this country. And I think, you know, you've seen the Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who is on the the leftward most wing of the Democratic Party essentially say, look, Chris Dodd's bill doesn't go nearly far enough. We need to cap interest rates that the credit card companies can choose. We have to have a Consumer Financial Protection Agency that exists outside of the Fed. We need more voices for average people looking at this process. And I would guess you will see more and more of that, Diane.
All right, to Norman, Arkansas. Let's go to Daniel. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
One more thing on the health care thing. First of all, I want to say I am not a Republican or Democrat. I'm not political in any kind of way. But I want to say that it is not the job of the government to force or to provide health care for people. If the government can force us to buy health insurance, they can force us to do anything. How dare anyone try to force me to buy health insurance? Anyone who agrees with this bill is, I believe, a communist at heart.
Wow.
Well, there you heard it. I mean, that's to me, that you hear this from Tea Party people. You hear it around the country. It's just a resistance to the idea of government's big hand. I think someone said, did you carry the mama state?
Yeah, the nanny state.
Nanny state.
Nanny
state.
You know, but the thing about it is, okay, say it is my right to decide to go around without health insurance. If I get run over by a truck and end up in an emergency room, the rest of society is going to have to pay my bill.
Well, you ever see people without helmets riding motorcycles around the country? You think, how is that possible?
Well,
first, they say, you know what? I have a right to ride my motorcycle and enjoy the wind.
And so the way Mitt Romney in the state of Massachusetts sold this idea was he framed it as personal responsibility. So I think that is probably how you're going to hear the other side of this argument.
But isn't it interesting that Mitt Romney now has a very different position, Ray, a government?
It is fascinating, Diana, as someone who spends too much of my time thinking about the 2012 presidential race. You could argue that this bill passing is bad news for Mitt Romney in that it is not entirely dissimilar. In fact, there are many similar provisions to what he did in Massachusetts. It's, if you remember back, he started to run on his health care bill in 2008 before he realized that that was a non-go, bad loser, straight loser in a Republican primary.
Chris Aleza, WashingtonPost.com. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And finally, to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Frank. You're on the air.
Well, your conversation has made me change my comment. I will say one thing as a member of the public, as a taxpayer, you know, well, one thing we seldom do is admit when we, the public, screw up, and we do. So to the point of the polls that say the vast majority of people are against this health care reform, you know, the polls, you must, I think, admit, are sometimes a measure of our degree of being misinformed. And people like Rush Limbaugh, I don't know what Rush Limbaugh makes now. It's $100 million, $150 million a year. It's because he sways so many people, and there's many more like him. That's where these people who are answering these polls get many of their opinions. And it's disregarded, and the facts are irrelevant.
That's an interesting point.
I was sort of amused a couple of weeks ago when Rush Limbaugh said if this bill passes, he's going to go to Costa Rica to get his health care. Costa Rica, it turns out, is a place that has government-run health care.
You know, Diane, I do think, though, that just because it's misinformation doesn't mean it's not influential. And I think we've seen
that happen.
That's exactly right. We've seen that happen. The problem for Democrats is, especially given that we have a very, very important election rapidly approaching, can they re-educate or educate for the first time? Because to Juan's earlier point, they did a terrible job from a message point of view educating particularly, and I think the key here is particularly people who already have health insurance. People who don't have health insurance are for this bill. It's the people who – and it's a much larger group of people who already have health insurance that they've not sold it to. The question is, can they cut through using – once the bill is in place, can they cut through some of what they believe to be vast, vast scads of misinformation to tell people what is in this bill and why it is good.
President
for
Obama says to members of Congress when they come to the White House, this is the right thing to do. Let's ignore the politics for the second. This is an important step to take. But let's go back to the caller's point. In terms of self-interest, let's forget Rush Limbaugh. If you need health insurance in this country, or you have health insurance and you're saying, well, how do I benefit? Well, wait a second. I mean, I might have to pay higher taxes to cover these $32 million, and the Republicans on the Hill say, you know what, there are other ways we could go about this. We could create high-risk pools, and we don't have to have everybody have to buy insurance, et cetera. And you're thinking, well, so you mean I might have to pay more taxes? Oh, my Medicare benefits might be cut. Then you say, wait, it's not all about misinformation. There are people who look in terms of self-interest and have come to the calculation that this may not be the best thing for them. And they're not foolish, by the way. I think, as some of the calls have indicated, costs are likely to go up.
Juan Williams, NPR News analyst, also Fox News political analyst, author of numerous books. Chris Alize, he's the author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com. And Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. And by the way, if you'd like to see the health care bill, you can go to rules.house.gov, and it's up there. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.